Hey, welcome to the Chess Experience. On this show, it's all about helping adult improvers. I want to make learning chess easier for you to navigate, and I also want you to have a more fun experience along the way. I'm your host, Daniel Lona, a fellow chess amateur. Let's get to it. This show is sponsored by Chess.com, the world's largest chess community. One of Chess.com's most popular features is called Game Review. This feature weaves together a lot of benefits in one post-game analysis. For example, you can see how accurately you played, whether you made any moves that were deemed brilliant or great, which makes me feel a lot better about my chess when I get one of those. And Game Review also offers a virtual coach that gives insights on every move. It'll also show you alternate lines that would have been better for you to help you understand how you can improve your game. So go on chess.com, play a game, and try out the Game Review. Welcome to this week's episode. Let's be honest. In spite of our passion for the game, there are a lot of mistakes you and I make as club players at the board. But as we strive to improve, it's important to know which of these mistakes are the most critical to work on. That is, the ones that if we address them, can give you and I the biggest bang for our efforts. Which is what today's episode is all about. The top mistakes club players make and how to work toward improving them. And for that topic, I have my first returned guest of the show, National Master and world-renowned coach, Dan Heisman. Dan is the ultimate coach for adult improvers. He's written over a dozen chess books, and everyone that I think at a club level should read is A Guide to Chess Improvement. Dan Heisman also has a popular YouTube channel with over 200 videos that I recommend checking out. There are very few chess instructors who are as good as he is at getting to the heart of what club players need to improve and articulating those problems and solutions so well. Here is our interview. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Dan. How are you today?
Hi, Dan. How's it going? Thanks for inviting me on your podcast again.
Yeah, absolutely. I am doing well. I'm excited to have you back on. You have been requested a lot of times by my audience to reappear on the show. So that is a big part of why I'm having you again. And of course, I thought our first episode was very helpful for people. And today, I'd like to discuss a subject that I think you're just extremely well-versed in, which is very common or top mistakes that are made by club players. And there's two reasons why, in particular, I am excited to have you talk about this. One is, like I've sort of alluded to already, is just you've spent many years exploring this subject through coaching others and offering help online to people on this. And the other reason is that I think you address a lot of different areas within this topic that many other coaches and title players do not. So I'm excited to talk about some things that are maybe less commonly discussed outside of your YouTube channel. Okay, so with all that said, let's dive in. Some years ago, you coined the phrase hope chess as a common mistake made by club players. And since then, I've noticed that a lot of people have gotten the original definition wrong. So let's start with like what is the correct definition and meaning of hope chess?
Okay, well, there's two answers to that. The first answer is there's no correct meaning of hope chess because there's no official dictionary of chess. And I coined the phrase I wrote an article for Chess Cafe. It was the first article I wrote for them for their Skittles Room called The Secrets of Real Chess. And I gave three levels of thought process, which were flip coin chess, hope chess, and real chess. And I had a very specific definition. But since then, people have kind of taken the name and run with it and said anything that you hope for in a game of chess is hope chess. For instance, if you make a bad move and you hope your opponent doesn't see it, that's hope chess. If you make a threat and hope your opponent doesn't meet it, that's hope chess. And all of those things are perfectly fine. They're not my original intention, but that doesn't make them wrong. So the key to your sentence is really what was the original definition, not the correct one. The answer to that is it meant that you make a move and you don't look to see what your opponent's dangerous checks, captures, or threats would be on the next move so that you don't actually know if you can meet them. And when they actually make them, you go, uh-oh, what do I do now? And then you hope that you can meet them. And if you can, then you're lucky. And if you can't, then you're maybe just losing the game right on the spot.
I see. So do you think that happens more often because of a, like a mindset where people are just, like you said, like just hopeful, like, oh, let's just hope there isn't a threat attitude? Or is it that they haven't like really learned to adopt that thought process to always check for what threats are possible?
Well, it's a complex subject as to what causes these things. One of the things I changed as a nuance over the years was, what's the difference between what people, let's say, under 1400 do and what people between 1400 and 1700 do? Because they all play hope chess. But what people, and when I play people between 1400 and 1700 and they make an unsafe move and I do something and then they go, uh-oh, what am I going to do? And then it turns out they lose material. And after the game, I ask them, why did you make that move? I almost always get the same answer, which I'm sure you could guess. They all say, I didn't see it. Okay, that's the term they use. And that term goes along with my saying, you can't play what you don't see. Mm. But when I question them as to, did you actually look at all my checks, captures, and threats that were dangerous? Their answer is almost always no. So what that means is everybody, to some extent, except for beginners, uses what I would call their tactical vision to determine if their move is safe. So they look at a move, and if they don't see any danger based on all the tactics they've studied, then they assume the move is safe. Yeah. The problem is that there's lots and lots and lots of easy moves that would refute a move that would make it not safe that may not be part of anyone's tactical vision. It could be a fairly easy, you know, one or two move combination that wins material that is not part of your tactical vision. So that tends to be what 1400 to 1700s do. And even to some extent, maybe 12 to 1400s, where they make them, they imagine the move in their mind. They think, oh, this move does the things that I want to do. I don't see any danger. And then they do it. And then, of course, if they're playing someone good and there is danger, the opponent goes boom, boom, boom. And they go, oh, I didn't see that. But the better players over 1700 don't do that. They say, if I make this move, what are all his dangerous moves? And can I meet them? And if they find one that they can't meet, then they don't play the move.
Yeah, I can vouch for that. What you're saying just sounds true from my own experience, which it being, you know, maybe on the low end of that 1400 to 1700 group, where to me, like, looking for checks and captures is pretty straightforward. there's not a lot of ambiguity in that. But the threats, looking for threats to me is, I think, more challenging and harder to see, as you said. So
right, I've actually tested people by asking them, you know, find all the moves that white can play in this position that we would consider threats. And they have a very difficult time doing that, partly because they don't even know what the definition of a threat is. It's one of those things they think they know it when they see it, but really they don't, because they just really don't even know what a threat is. If you make a move and you say, what kind of move is this? And they might say, that's a threat. But if you say, show me all the threats in the position, they can't do it.
Interesting. So how do you recommend people, you know, not fall into that trap of hope chess?
Okay, well, that's a long answer. We don't want to take up too much of the podcast. So sure. I tell people, think of fixing your thought. And really what we're talking about here are thought process errors, as opposed to the kind of errors you make over the board. Like a common amateur error might be, you know, gee, when people play D4, D5, C4, they play knight F6. You know, that's a common error. But we're really talking about things that are more like in your mind, so to speak, than on the board. One of the ways to avoid things like this is, it's just like when you're in Alcoholics Anonymous and they have the 10 steps to recovery kind of thing. And the first step is to realize you have a problem. And the second step is to want to do something about it. And I use a one of our guys at our club. I think he won't mind me mentioning his first name. His name is Gary. Gary's been coming to our club for 30 years, and he almost always plays fast. And you know that Gary would play a lot better if he took most of the time that we give him, but he doesn't want to. He wants to play a fast game, and even though you give him a lot of time, and when he finishes the game, he wants to play another game and another game, and he just wants to play a bunch of fast games every night. And as far as I'm concerned, there's nothing wrong with that. Gary's perfectly happy playing fast and not playing as well as he could. And if you ask Gary, don't you want to play better and by playing slower? He goes, no, it's not as much fun. I come here to have fun. I want to play fast. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly okay. So in order to solve these problems, the first two steps is you have to realize you have this problem. And the second step is you have to want to fix it. Because if you don't want to fix it and you're perfectly happy playing the way you are, then you're not going to be able to, the next steps you're not going to be able to do. And I wrote about this in my article on chess.com called The Train Story, where I had learned to do this and I was getting to be a pretty good player. I had been playing about a year and a half, maybe 2 years in tournaments. And I had a day where in those days, there was no sudden death time control. So the games could go 6 hours or so. And I got paired with two 1900 players when I was like 1700. And I played 12 hours during the day and I was exhausted. I was coming home on the train and I said to myself, you know, I bet I'm good enough now. I bet I could try much less hard and still play a decent game against people and not be so exhausted as I am now. I said, maybe I should just do that. Maybe that would be better. And then I thought for about 30 seconds and I said, if you're going to do something, you got to do it right. I could never look myself in the mirror if I did that. So I want to play every move the best I possibly can, whether it's a speed game or a slow game. I want to look myself in the mirror after each game and say, I couldn't possibly have played any better on any move. I did the very best I ever could. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to do that, then you're not going to solve these problems. I know this doesn't completely answer your question, but it's the most important part of the answer, which is you got to buy into the fact that you want to do it. Now, once you want to do it, then we can start talking about things like, okay, so for instance, suppose you play 5,000 straight 10-minute games on chess.com or Elite Chess, and then someone sticks you in a 45-45 game, what's going to happen? How good is your thought process? And the answer is, it's not just that you're used to playing fast that makes you play fast in that situation. It's also the fact that you don't know what to think about. When I first played my first three tournaments, I didn't know what to think about, so I played fast because I didn't know any better. But by my fourth tournament, I started to learn what I was supposed to think about. And then I slowed down dramatically and started taking all my time. But you have to know what to think about. So when you play all those speed games and you don't have a chance to learn how to think, and then all of a sudden you play those slower games, you're not going to know what to think about. And therefore, you're going to play fast because you don't know any better. So you have to practice playing. It's not that you shouldn't play any fast games. Fast games are perfectly great. People are always quoting me as saying, Dan says you shouldn't play any fast games. Well, I've never said that in my life. But you want to play consistently slow games so you have a chance to practice on every move doing the kind of things that we're talking about here. For instance, taking the time to say, is my move safe? Is this candidate move safe? If I make this move, what are his dangerous chicks, captures, and threats? And, you know, what would I do if he did this threat? What would I do if he did this check? You know, am I able to meet these okay? That doesn't make you a good player, but not doing it does make you a weaker player.
Yeah, for sure. I like that answer. And just starting with just addressing the problem, being aware of it and wanting to fix it. Those are elements that I don't think people would consider in how to solve that. So that is definitely a great place to begin. This is a good segue, actually, from what you were talking about, the subject of club players often playing too fast. And personally, I run into that all the time when I play my 45-45 games on chess.com. Even though I choose the classical setting like that, the vast majority of my opponents still play it kind of like as if they were in a 10-5 time control. So I guess my first question is, why do you think that's so common? And then after that, how can they, you know, get better at slowing down?
Okay. So gets back to the previous point is, are they like Gary? Do they want to play it that way? They just want to get the game over with and get the instant gratification? And the answer is, if they do, there's nothing wrong with that. It's perfectly okay. And if I were you, I would say silently to myself, thanks for the handicap.
Right.
one of the things I always tell people is never start a game without the intention of using almost all your time. So, for instance, if you're playing a 5-minute game, you're going to take almost 5 minutes. If you're playing a 45-minute game, you're going to take almost 45 minutes. Sure, it's true. If your opponent falls into a trap in the opening and resigns after 6 moves and you wanted to take 45 minutes, you only end up taking 3. That's okay because you were playing at the speed where you intended to. But you're always trying to play games where you want to take all your time. Well, what's happening with your opponents is they're not doing that. They're not playing games where they're intending to take all their time. And again, I can't repeat this enough. There's nothing wrong with that as long as they're perfectly willing to give you a handicap and play fast. But if there's someone who comes to me for lessons and they say, gee, I'm stuck at 1300, I want to get better. Well, then I have to assume that they do want to play better and they want to find better moves. And the only way you find better moves is by looking at multiple candidate moves and having the skill to compare them and figure out which ones give you better positions. And that takes practice and that takes time. But a lot of people don't want to do that. Now, why don't they want to do it? Well, they've got instant gratification. They want to play quick moves. They want to get a quick result. They want to get to the next game. Why they're doing that in a 45-45 game instead of a 10-5 game. Maybe it's because they joined the 45-45 league to be with their friends or something, but then they don't have any intention of using all their time. Right. So if we assume that they do play too fast and that they do want to take more time, one of the first things they have to do is understand what is going on your time. And of course, the first question, which we just been talking about, is asking if all your candidate moves are safe. But that also implies that you've got multiple candidate moves. Purdy said, look wide before you look deep. Well, and I say you can't play what you don't see. So if you're not the kind of person who's used to playing a slow game where you say, what are all the things my opponent's trying to do? What are all the things I'm trying to do? If I know all the things I'm trying to do and I know all the things he's trying to do, it should flow naturally for that what my candidate moves are. Maybe there's only one, maybe there's six, but I'm either trying to stop something he's trying to do or trying to do something that I'm trying to do. And those are your candidate moves. And then once you get the candidate moves, then you have to ask which ones are safe. And then you have the hard part, which is to figure out of all the ones that I still want to play, whether they're safe or not, what's going to happen after them and how good are they and which one do I like? And when I listen to good players think against weaker players thinking, the stronger players are always comparing things. If I do A, B, C and reach position C prime, would I rather do that than do X, Y, Z and reach position Z prime? Well, lower rated players never ask themselves those kind of questions. But those are the kind of things you eventually learn how to do. And eventually you play slower once you learn that those are the things you have to do. If you don't learn those are the things you have to do and you don't want to play slower or you don't know how to play slower, then you can't. Now, a lot of my students say, but Dan, I know all those things and I still play too fast. Then when I quiz them and I say, well, when you came up with this candidate move, did you have other candidate moves? And they say no. Or I'd say, if you came up with this candidate move, did you ask yourself if it was safe? And they said, yes, I didn't see any danger. I say, well, did you look at the checks, captures, and threats? And they say no. And I go, well, those are the things that are going to slow you down if you do those things. I had one student who said he just couldn't. He learned all those things and he was doing them and he just couldn't slow down. And I said, well, that doesn't, something's wrong with your statement, because if you're doing all those things, you can't play a move in 7 seconds.
Right.
There's no way to pick out 4 candidate moves, ask if they're all safe, and then start to compare them in 7 seconds. It's just not possible. And yet he's still moving in 7 seconds.
Right.
So all of these things go into the issue, but it all starts with A, do you want to improve it? B, how do you improve it? C, are you willing to try those things? D, are you playing slow enough games that you can practice those things over and over again so they become habit? And so on and so forth. You've got to have all those things working together. You could want to slow down, but if then you go out and play 100 straight 10-minute games, you're going to get into the bad habits again of, you know, I just don't have the time to do those things. And the answer is, you're right, you don't. So you're playing good 10-minute chess, but if you want to be an expert or a master, they're not going to give you an expert title for your 10-minute games. Maybe in the future, they'll have a rapid chess 10-minute expert title or something, and you could try for that. But right now, you know, you don't get titles in chess unless you play games of at least 30 minutes. That's the way USCF and FIDE generally work.
Right, right. So let's talk about the opposite mistake, one that I am still working my way through myself, which is the mistake of playing too slow. What are the common errors that lead into that, that have somebody end up playing too slow? What mistakes are they making?
Well, Rousen has a chapter on this, and the name of his chapter is perfectionism. So obviously people who have perfectionist things, you know, they're like type A personalities, you know, very, you know, anal kind of people, they tend to play too slow because they're trying to be too perfect about it. Then there's the people who obviously are so afraid of making a mistake that they make the bigger one of playing too slow, which is exactly what Rousen says in his book, which is one of the things you don't want to do in chess is beat yourself. You always want your opponent to be the one to beat you. After the game, you want to say, he played better than me. You don't want to say, I played too slow and I beat myself. That's right. A terrible way to lose a game. You want your opponent to beat you. You don't want him to beat you, but if you're going to lose, you want that to be the reason.
Exactly.
So you have to do that. Now, I basically break my students who play at the wrong speed into 3 categories. One category is people who play too fast but don't know how to play slow and want to play slow. Then there's people who play too fast who may know how to play slower or don't want to play slower, and they just want to play fast, and that's their personality. And then there's the people who play too slow. The ones that are the easiest to help are the ones who play too fast because they don't know what to think about and they would like to play better, but they just don't know how to do it and they're not used to playing slow games where they have a lot of time. Once you give them a steady diet of slow games and you teach them what to think about, they're usually okay. It's the other two groups where it's more psychological that's the problem. Did you see the article that I posted on chess.com that my student, the psychologist from Scotland, wrote?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So he's a professional psychologist. And I said, you know, if I know what my student's doing wrong and they know what they're doing wrong and I tell them how to fix it and they know how to fix it and they still won't fix it, I said, should subcontract to you and send them out to you and you can return them to me when you fix their problem. So he wrote an article about people that play too slow. So along with Rowson's chapter in his book, The Seven Deadly Chess Sins on playing too slow, I have the psychologist's take on that. And if you go to my website, danheisman.com, and you look under articles and you go down to chess.com articles, it's an article on playing too slow. And I say, you know, this isn't written by me. It's written by, I forget off the top of my head, Dr. So-and-so wrote the article and I'm just posting it for him so it'll get more views. So he talks about that. But people who play too slow, you know, people say to me, but if I play faster, won't I lose more games more quickly? And the answer is, well, of course. But for every one game that you lose in 15 moves where you would have lost in 30, you might have 10 games where you're now on move 30 and 40 and 50 where you have a chance to win the game that before you were in terrible time trouble and you just gave away the game. So, yes, maybe one game out of 10 or 20, by playing at a normal speed, the speed you should play, you're going to lose a game that you wouldn't have lost if you had played too slow, but then you have a chance in all the other games. And of course, all your opponents have the same problems you do. So you playing slower than them where you're playing too slow is not going to be a benefit to you. It's going to be a terrible detriment. When I used to play in tournaments and people would play too slow, I would say to myself, oh, good. Why don't you keep thinking and just give me the game? That's easier than me having to actually make good moves. You know, if you want to give me the game, okay. So, and I think one of the problems that people have who play too slow is not only do they play too slow earlier in the game, but they kind of think that if they play at a normal pace, when I say normal pace, an average pace earlier in the game, that they can continue to do that. Well, that doesn't make sense. That's why Botvinnik has the Botvinnik rule of using no more than about 20% of your time for your first 15 moves. Because let's say you're in a 40-move game and you use 15/40ths of your time for the first 15 moves, which is 3/8ths of your time, instead of using 1/4 of your time. One-fifth of your time. Well, 3/8ths is, you know, almost twice of 1/5. That's 3/8ths is 37.5% instead of 20%. So you're playing twice as slow. And what you're doing is you're playing your non-critical moves at an average pace. But that means when you get critical moves, you have to play them at the same pace. And of course, you can't do that because complicated positions can't be played at the same speed as positions where it really doesn't matter much what you're doing and there's not much happening. But that's what they do. And of course, that gets them into terrible trouble when the critical moves come up later in the game. So, you know, more than anything else, the buy-in for the slow players is the most important thing. They have to buy in and be willing to do something about it and take steps to do about it. A lot of times they understand their problem. They want to do something about the problem. They know what to do. And that it all ends there. They really don't want to buy in and take those painful steps of making moves faster where they might actually lose the game faster early in the game. And the answer is, well, sure. But that's what your opponents are doing. They're playing at a normal speed and they have a chance to lose the game, too. And of course, that's also why you study basic tactics. So hopefully you don't make those moves early in the game that are just basic errors that lose you the game quickly. But the faster and more quickly you can recognize safe moves, the better it would be for you to play faster chess because then you have confidence that you can do that. In fact, playing speed chess, you know, helps you do that because if you can play a 5-minute game by playing almost all safe moves, you should be able to play a safe move in a minute or two.
Yeah, that's a good reminder for myself because I do play enough blitz. And I'm, as you just said, I am able to make those first dozen or so moves without blundering. I almost never do in the first dozen moves. And I've made them all in the span of, you know, 1 minute. And yet somehow I forget that I can make 12 moves without any serious errors once I step up to a classical game. I'm not sure why that is, but that's a good reminder, though. I appreciate that.
But it should put you on the right track. The more you do that, the more you get. And we're not saying you should play your, you know, 45-45 games where you play the first 12 moves at the same speed as a 5-minute game.
Right.
But on the other hand, you don't need 20 times as much time either.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You mentioned to me in one of your emails that a common mistake is that club players will put strategy ahead of tactics in their study. And I definitely see that all the time. You know, despite their best intentions, maybe of trying to get better at chess, even people who are just 11 or 1200, they'll spend, you know, way more time on advanced strategy books and things like that, advanced relative, at least to their level. What do you think is happening there? Like, what's the allure, and what do they need to understand so that they don't fall into this trap?
Okay. You're getting me into these long answers I don't want to do, but okay. That's why I'm here. All right. So first of all, let's say you've heard about me talking about the computer on the ICC that was programmed to play terrible, and they had it only look two moves ahead, which is four ply. And after that, it was completely blind. But within two ply, it always played safe moves. And if you made a mistake within, sorry, not two ply, four ply, if you made a mistake within two moves or four ply, and it could win material within those four ply, it would always do that. And mm-hmm. Its USCF rating, when I ask people to guess it, they usually guess low. But the equivalent USCF rating of such a computer was 1650, even though its strategy was relatively poor. It wasn't non-existent. Mm-hmm. Well, that tells you how important. Most USCF adults are not rated above 1650 unless they play I think regularly playing USCF adults are rated on the average above 1650. But if you just take all the USCF adults, including the ones that play irregularly, then the average rating is well under 1650. So they play worse than that. So that's how important safety is. If you can just play with safe within two moves, you could beat half the adult tournament players that play in the United States. Okay, well. But suppose I tell someone that and I say, you're a beginner. We're going to play a game of chess. All I want you to do is play safe. Make sure every move is safe. Look for checks, captures, and threats. Don't fall for any pins or forks or double attacks or anything like that. If they're a complete beginner, but let's say they know just enough to know what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. what's the basic problem?
Well, if they're still beginners, they're not going to spot many tactics.
Well, that's true, but there's going to be a bigger problem. Why do people play chess?
That's a good question.
Well, unless you're one of the top players in the world and you're doing it for a living, I think I know the answer to the question.
For enjoyment, for pleasure.
Yeah, for fun. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if I told someone, pay no attention to your strategy, just move your pieces back and forth until you see a tactic, that's no fun. It ruins the game.
Yeah.
So people, when they first learn how to play, they say to you, give me some tips about playing in the opening. And you say things like, well, try to use your pieces to control the center and try to get your king castled really fast and try to bring out all your pieces. Don't move the same pieces over and over again. Well, they love that because those basic strategy tips make the game fun for them that they try to do that follow those basic strategies. So you need that to make the game fun. And strategies are always fun. Yeah. But then we have the problems that come, like the ones that you talked about, which is, unfortunately, you could play reasonable strategy all the time, and then if you're not tactically alert, you could have a perfectly good position and just make a terrible blunder, and it just loses a knight, and you just lose the game. So the net effect of playing all those good strategies when you're playing someone else who's terrible and you're terrible is you have the fun, but the game is really decided on the tactics. I think I've been quoted as saying, if both players are rated under 1,500 FIDE, then there's about a 99% chance that at some point in the game, one or the other one will have a Bane level tactic or easier, mm-hmm. whether they see it or not. They may not see it, but it's going to be there.
Yeah.
So that means there's about a 99% chance the game could be decided by very, very basic counting and basic tactics. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't use the strategy. So people are intrigued by the strategy. The strategy is what makes the game fun, maybe even more so than finding the tactics. So that's an important part. It's the fun part that they want to do that. Another thing is when you study math, you have no choice. When you go to first grade, they don't give you a geometry book. They don't give you a book on trigonometry. They don't give you a book on calculus. They say, let's make sure everybody knows how to count to 10, and then we'll work on, you know, integers, and then we'll work on like how to add integers and things like that. So So that's what they start people with. And then they build them up and say, well, now that you know how to add them, let's show you how to subtract them. And now you know how to add and subtract, let's teach you how to multiply and divide. And boom, we can't divide 2 into 3. So let's teach you about fractions and so on. Mm-hmm. So people build up in a way that they have no choice because they're in school. But in chess, if you go to the bookstore, every book's going to say to you, this is the book for you. This is the book that will help you tremendously. Buy Franzen's Best Games, where we're going to talk about all of Grandmaster Franzen's great strategies and how he cleverly outthought of Grandmaster Moven in his game in 1942. Well, right. Then everybody reads those books and they go, oh, I didn't know any of this stuff. Wow, I saw how he greatly controlled the C-file or the dark squares or the he took advantage of that isolated pawn. But I'm not going to get any isolated pawns in my game. So unfortunately, you know, it's like, yes, but unfortunately they haven't mastered the Bain book or the Giannatos book or any of the Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess. And when you look at their games, you're like, well, yes, it's very nice that you're trying to avoid an isolated pawn, but over here you're just losing a knight.
Right.
So that's what happens. But it's understandable because they want to have fun. And I recognize this problem. I wrote a novice nook many years ago called How Much Strategy to Start, where I hypothesized that within a 7-page novice nook, I could talk about every strategic thing that you would need to know to become a 1700 player. In other words, wow. If you did all these strategical things right and you understood these seven pages of strategy, then if you started playing real chess and you studied tactics and stuff, you wouldn't need more than those 7 pages until you got to be about 1700. And wow. Then I did a video on it for my YouTube channel, which basically was the exact same thing. I've been trying to duplicate, you know, a lot of my novice nooks that now that they're a little harder to get a hold of. YouTube channel.
What was the name of the YouTube video for that?
Probably the same thing. How much strategy to start?
Okay.
I try to put a little blurb at the start of every title now to put the word chess on it, because I was told by the marketing people that that helps the search engines. So I don't just call it how much strategy to start, because they may be thinking I'm talking about strategy and putting a band together. So I say something like improve your chess, how much strategy, or learn. If it's a basic one, I'll call it learn chess - how much strategy to start.
Yeah.
So I'm always going to my YouTube channel and like fiddling around with it, trying to make it more user friendly.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's amazing. Just 7. And I think I vaguely remember that the like you said, the 7 things to know in strategy to get to, I think you said 1700 USCF?
Yeah, basically that's the hook chess barrier. So I basically said, if you can do these strategical things pretty well, like move every piece once, put every piece twice, use all your pieces all the time, which is one of the use all your pieces all the time is the single most important strategical concept that there is. But the other basic strategic concepts all come from Steinitz. And I tell my students, go to Exeter Chess Club, Google Exeter Chess Club, Steinitz's rules, and read the 1-page summary of Steinitz's rules, because all strategy is based on Steinitz's rules. So if you use Steinitz's rules and use that one statement, which is, you know, use all your pieces all the time, and then put some nuances in there, like, you know, what are the weak pawns? What's a good pawn structure? What's not a good pawn structure? You know, that kind of thing. So you're aware rooks belong on open files, you know, stuff like that, which you could write within 7 pages fairly easily. Mm-hmm. It's going to cover most of the things that you really, when I say most, the very overwhelming majority of things that you probably need to know. And all the strategy above that isn't going to help you very much if you play hook chess, because if you're 1400 and you know all the strategy and then you play a 1900 who's actually calculating and figuring out what's safe and what's not, then eventually when the game gets complicated, you're going to make a move and he's going to go, you can't do that. Boom, 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 boom. You lose the exchange and you lose the game. And then you're going to say, oh, I held my own. I had good strategy until move 27 against this 1900 player. And then I messed up when it got complicated, but I was right in there with him. I was, the computer said I was perfectly equal after 27 moves. Unfortunately, after 30 moves, I was down -5.7.
Right. We leave that part out.
Yeah.
Thinking about that balance that, you know, in particular, I think adults, you know, need to strike between being able to enjoy the game, as we discussed, you know, by having some strategy that they can learn, but also paying attention to, you know, getting, you know, very proficient at tactics, at least the basic ones. You know, I'm just curious, like, how you recommend people, you know, find a decent balance between that. Because I have full faith in the 7 things you need to know, like you said, but I suspect that adults might get an itch after that to still want to study some strategy. I'm thinking maybe your answer to that would be going through annotated game books.
Yeah, you actually, I was, as you were saying that, I was thinking, well, That's going to, the nice thing about Undertale game books is they've got everything: openings, middle games, end games, strategy, tactics. Some of them even had time management. You know, I learned about time management from reading an annotated game book. So, you know, they've got everything. So yeah, you get a tremendous amount of strategy. Now, when people say to me, "Well, what's a good basic strategic book to start with?" Oh, I say, that's easy. Get Jeff Coakley's book, Winning Chess Strategy for Kids, which, of course, is not just for kids. It's a wonderful introduction to chess strategy. You know, are there more advanced books? Absolutely. But it's nice to start with the basics. And Jeff does about as good a job as you could possibly hope. And one of the things I'm looking at now, which I don't have all the books, but at least they were nice enough to send me a copy, was the step books. They sent me a copy of Step 1, which is basically has nothing to do with strategy. It has to do with recognizing where the pieces can go and where they're safe and what does it mean to attack a piece? What does it mean to capture a piece? But they do a very good job. And I would imagine when they finally get up to step book number 3, which I don't have, they're probably going to be pretty good about starting to give you some basic strategic concepts. But annotated game books like Logical Chess Move by Move is a good starter book. If you want the book strictly on strategy, then Winning Chess Strategy for Kids by Coakley. But you just, you know, you want to have fun, but you want to modify that fun a little bit to the point where you want to understand what's important. And unfortunately, until you get to be certainly into toward the upper thousands, it's much more likely that the tactics are going to decide your game than the strategy. But when you watch the Grandmasters play, who gets all the tactics?
I'm not exactly sure how to answer that.
The answer is the person who has the better position strategically.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, but it felt like too easy to say that.
Tactics flow from the strategically better position when you're both good players and you're making safe moves.
Yeah.
But see, with beginners, that's not true anymore. Suppose two people are rated 900 and one person used better strategy and gets a better position. Does that mean he has a 99.9% chance to get the next tactic? And the answer is no. He could be on the next move. He could make a completely unsafe move and give his opponent a tactic.
Right.
So for people above 17, 18, 1900, the tactics flow from the superior positions. But for low-rated players, people way below 1700, tactics flow usually from your opponent's oversights, not from the fact that you strategically outplayed him. So yeah, that's unfortunate because, you know, it's the same thing with beginners. Beginners love to make silly threats. They love to make silly threats because their opponent misses the silly threat and then they win and they get psychological feedback that maybe making silly threats is the way to play. But then when they start playing intermediate players and they make those same silly threats that are easily met, unless that silly threat also is strategically okay, then they deteriorate their position by making silly threats and then they lose games because their opponent doesn't fall for them. But they psychologically, from playing the other beginners, they thought, oh, well, that's the way you play chess. You make silly threats, and then whoever misses the most silly threats loses.
Right. Yeah. So there's another common mistake that you brought up as a potential area for discussion that I haven't really heard much talked about in other areas of chess content. So I appreciate discussing this, which is not reviewing games with your opponents. Let's just start with, like, why is that an important practice?
Oh, so many reasons. All right, we'll start with the most obvious one. I don't care whether you go over the game with an engine, with a grandmaster, with your coach. None of them can answer the following questions. Why did your opponent do that? What was he trying to do? What did he think you might do? And why did he think that? And what was going on in the game? We can guess. We can look at the game and say, I guess your opponent was hoping that you would do this, you know, and that's why he made the silly move. Or maybe he thought, maybe he missed the fact that he could do this and that's why he did that. But we're just guessing. He knows. So you can find out an awful lot about chess by asking your opponents questions after the game, like, well, why did you do that? Or, but also the second important answer to that question is, you know, what's the name of the movie called Pass It Through or Pass It Down or whatever it was called?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're playing someone better than you, then when you go over the game with them, it's like getting a free lesson. And then people say, well, yeah, but why should I go over a game with weaker players? And I say, well, I guess you're not seeing the big picture, because if the good, better player said the same thing about you, he wouldn't go over the game with you and give you that free lesson. So if you're 1700 and you want the 2000 player to go over the game with you, then when you play a 1400, he wants you to go over the game too and help you with the things that he might not know that he can be helped with. So you want to pass it down when you do that. And the amount of learning that can go on when people do this is fantastic, because, you know, when you're playing good players, they know so much and about what happened in the game. And you have all these questions about the game and should I have done this? Where did I go wrong? Why was this bad? I thought this was okay. You know, they're going to help you with all those kind of things really tremendously. I like to tell a little story about this, which is one of my students was Dan Yeager. Dan Yeager not only won the National High School Championship, but he won the Denker Championship of High School Champions. So he was not only the high school champion, but he was the champion of the champions as well. And I'm very proud of that because, you know, I've never had a student become a grandmaster because all my students become doctors and lawyers and Indian chiefs. And it's like, yes, we wanted to get our PhD rather than become a professional chess player. And I can't tell their parents, no, tell your kid not to go to medical school. Tell him to try to become a grandmaster. Well, that doesn't work that way very often. So anyway, but I've had students do very, very well like Dan. And Dan was playing a grandmaster. I think it was the World Open and he lost. And after the game, they were in the Skittles room going over the game. And the grandmaster was very seriously telling Dan what was going on in the game and helping him. Now, Dan's like a 2400 player. And here's this 2700 player telling him all about what's going on in the game. And Dan's listening intently. And I came over and I stood over Dan's shoulder and they were talking and talking and talking. And then eventually I said something. I said, oh, how about this? And the grandmaster looked up to me with his eyes wide and said something of the effect of, who the hell are you? And I said, oh, I'm National Master Dan Heisman. I was Dan's coach when he was younger. And the grandmaster was very disappointed that I actually gave a reasonable answer. And he said, oh, okay, then. Well, in that case, I guess you could stay, but please keep it down. Well, what's the moral of the story?
I mean, you want to listen to the higher rated player.
The moral of the story is going over your game with your opponent is so important that grandmaster was willing to yell at me and tell me to shut up because he was doing something so important to help hit my former student or my, I guess you could call him my current student since, you know, people say once you teach you, they're always my student. But he thought it was so important that I couldn't even say all I said was one thing in 10 minutes and he jumped all over me because that's how important it is. Well, if everybody felt that way, nobody would ask me, why should I go over the game with my opponent? That's how important it is. And what people tell me is when they go to tournaments and there's time to go over the game, there's a direct correlation between the strength of your opponent and their willingness to go over the game with you.
Yeah.
The stronger your opponent, the more they know how important it is and the more they'll go over the game. We're assuming that there's time, but the stronger your opponent, the more they know that it's important and the more they will absolutely go over the game with you if they don't have some place to run to or the next round's not starting, they will absolutely do it. And the weaker players have no idea why this is so important. And if they want to go over the game, they're like, no, why would I want to do that? That's why they're weak. One of the reasons why they're weaker players. Stronger players understand a lot about what it takes to become a good player. And it takes a lot of work. And one of the nice parts about the work is going over games with your opponent. Now, when you're online, it's that much harder, of course, but people will go over games with you online. They sometimes can type back and forth on the channel, or they can even call you on Skype or on Zoom and say, let's talk. I've had people on my Slack channel who get together with my other students, and after the game, they call each other on Zoom or Skype, and they go over the game together, you know, talking like we are now. So, you can do that. That's, of course, another one of my pet peeves is hitting buttons online to find opponents, but we won't get into that.
Right. Well, you know, I've noticed a trend recently past several of my tournaments, speaking of this subject. I'll start by saying I have the opportunity to go over the game in the Skittles room with my opponent. They've said yes, and I'm very happy about it. And then they take out the engine on their phone to look it over. And I've, every time they've done that, I've asked them I would prefer not to. I don't want to. To me, it's a complete waste of time. I can look at the engine alone. I'm later by myself. What I can't do, as you said, is ask them what they were thinking when I'm alone later. So it's unfortunate, but thankfully they've all said, okay, that's fine. But I've noticed that a lot of them just want to go over it with the engine, which is bizarre to me.
Well, first of all, you don't want to spoil their fun when they're going over the game. If that's what makes it fun for them, you have to let them have their fun.
Okay.
But the point is, they still want to answer the questions, what were you thinking? And I mean, they might want that instant gratification of knowing, gee, on that complicated move on move 27, did I play the right move? I want the engine to tell me. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they can tell you the answer too, but you don't want to take away from the rest. Now, suppose you want to get to a certain position. You want to say, oh, this is really interesting. I analyzed it this way. I want to hear how you analyze it. you could at that point say, why don't we turn off the engine for a couple of minutes, see what we can find, and then we'll compare it to what the engine says, rather than let the engine spoil our fun of trying to analyze the position.
Yeah.
So you can do that. But I very much sympathize with your point of view that they want to substitute the analysis with just letting the engine tell them. And by the way, I usually do that for myself. Why? Because I'm already a good player and I don't need to practice my analysis to get to be a better player. So I know I did the work during the game. Now I want to see what the quote truth is from the engine.
Right.
So yes, I understand.
Yeah. I know this won't be a small subject, but maybe we can talk about it for a few minutes. Sure. In the remaining, as a last question in the remaining time that we have. It's a hot topic. It's one that's discussed frequently on the show, but I appreciate hearing your perspective on it. The mistake that club players make of studying openings to the detriment of other areas of the game, meaning they're over studying, putting too much time on openings. I guess there's several questions I could ask about that problem. I guess I'll start by asking, why do you think they're so attracted to openings over other areas of the game?
Well, I don't think there's just one answer to that, but we'll give you a couple. One is that, again, you have this kind of instant gratification thing where, you know, if you can beat someone in the opening, you don't have to play the middle game or the end game. So people are like, oh, if I can get them to fall into this trap, I win the game and that the game's over and I don't have to do any more work. You know, another thing, you know, people say to me, what's the most important phase of the game, opening, middle game, or end game? And I have a standard answer for that. I say the opening is the most important because it's the only phase of the game you get to every single game. The middle game is the most important phase of the game because it's the most complex phase of the game. And that's where you're most likely to get the critical moves where you make mistakes and cost you the game. And the end game is the most important part of the game because that's the part of the game where you don't have any chance to come from behind. And it's much more likely that every move is critical in the end game. You move your king in the wrong direction and all of a sudden you're not drawing, you're losing. So that's the part of the game where almost every move could decide the game as opposed to earlier in the game when, you know, maybe how you bring out your pieces doesn't very much decide the game. Well, that's kind of a humorous answer because I'm saying all three phases, but the opening is very important. If the game is ending in the opening, you won't get to the other parts of the game. And a lot of people also feel like psychologically, if they get off to a bad start in the game, they get tortured. It's not like backgammon where you get off to a bad start and then the guy doubles you and you drop and you play the next game of the match. Well, in chess, you get off to a bad start and it's a 45-45 game. You could be tortured for the next 2 hours trying to hold this game that you made a mistake on move 7 and now you've been punished for the next 2 hours. So they go, oh, I'm never doing this again. I'm gonna learn my openings better so that I don't get tortured like this. So people want to get off to good starts in a game because it makes them psychologically find the game a lot more fun. And if the game's a lot more fun, then they want to play it. So there's lots of reasons why people want to study openings. And as I said, openings are important. It's just that like breathing or drinking, you can go overboard. You can breathe too much and hyperventilate. You could drink too much and drown. You could eat too much and explode from being too fat. These things are necessary. Well, it's important to know a fairly good amount about openings, but unless you're a professional chess player where the whole game might decide on who gets a smite advantage out of move 26, if you're rated below 1700, it's very, very unlikely that that's going to decide the game for you. I usually use the analogy of, let's say you study I give you a pill and you swallow it and you're not very good at openings. And now you swallowed that pill and that pill is a book on the Karo Kan and your rating's, let's say 1400. What's your rating after you swallow the pill?
Yeah. Cause I've heard you talk about this before. So I'm going to guess on the low end, 1500.
Yeah. I don't think it's that. I don't think it'll gain you 100 rating points. First of all, it won't help you when you're white unless you're an E4 player and your opponent plays the Karo Kan, and then you could use the stuff that you studied for black. Yeah. But if you're a D4 player, you're not going to get into any Karo Kans. If you're an E4 player and 90% of the people don't play Karo Kans, then it's not going to help you with white at all. And when you're black, if your opponent plays D4, it's not going to help you. If they play the English or Knight F3, it's not going to help you. Mm-hmm. What if your opponent is another beginner and you have this whole book of knowledge of the Karo Kan and your opponent, you know that E4, C6, D4, D5, and your opponent on the first move after E4, C6 doesn't know what to play and he plays, you know, Knight F3 or something. Well, maybe there's a note at the start of the book that if they do this, you just do this and this, and, you know, you're probably close to equal already, but that's like two moves because they don't know any of those book moves anyway. So, so my guess is like 1430, 1440.
Okay.
If you swallow a pill to memorize a book on the Caro Kann, but that doesn't make you an expert or a master. And it certainly doesn't get you up to 1700. Why? Well, let's say on the average, before you swallow that pill, that when you're black and someone plays E4, you know, on an average of six moves, whatever opening you were playing. But now that you swallow that pill, if people play book moves against you, you might know 15 moves. But on the average, let's say it doesn't go that far and they don't know it and you don't know it because they get you out of the book. Let's say it brings you up from six moves to eight or 10. Well, if before there were six moves where you played like a grandmaster and then the other 34, you played like a 1400, what's your rating?
Probably pretty close to 1400.
And if there's 10 moves where you play like a grandmaster and then there's 30 moves where you play like a 1400, now what's your rating?
I would still say pretty close to the same exactly. Because those extra two moves aren't really decisive.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening there. So, you know, we always talk about a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Well, a chess player is only as strong as his weakest moves. So if you play 36 moves like an 1800 and you play four moves like a 400, do you think we should add up 36 1800s plus four 1400s and divide by 40 to get your strength for the game?
No, definitely not.
It's not going to work. That would come out to like, you know, 1647 or something. Well, no, you're not 1647 if you play four moves like a 1400. You're probably more like a 900 or something. So it only takes one bad move to lose a game. If you play these terrible moves, well, studying all those openings isn't going to take that away from you. You're still going to have trouble when the game gets complicated. You'll just survive an extra four moves with a decent position up to move 10. So that's kind of why they do it, and that's why it's not all that effective. But that's not to say that if you're a grandmaster, that going over the game with the computer and saying that, you know, your next opponent played move 27 like this, and if you play him again, maybe you can find a better move 27 and win the candidates tournament. Well, that's going to be really, 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 really important.
Yeah, right.
That's why they hire all those trainers to go over the openings in the databases with their databases and with all these trainers, preparing them for the game so they have it all prepared.
Yeah. So my last question on this subject and pretty much for this episode, how does a club player strike the balance then? Because you know you did say that you know openings are important and shouldn't be completely neglected. How should they adjust their studying so that way they're
well? You know, they don't have to. But it gets back to the first thing we talked about, which is they have to do what's the most fun. Suppose they're a club player and they love openings. That's all they ever want to do. And they love studying them. And that's what makes the game fun.
Mm-hmm.
If they would do other things, it's not fun for them. And they shouldn't change. It's only if they really want to get better and they have that problem and their other things could be as much fun for them. Then they have to try to strike that balance. But there's no requirement for striking a balance. It's the willingness to get better and understanding, oh, I'm really good in the opening. I'm not so good when it comes to other things in the game, whether it be middle game, end game, strategy, tactics, time management, whatever are the things that you're bad at, you know, if you really want to improve and the other things are holding you back, then you have to be willing to realize what the problems are and to work on those problems. If you're not willing or you don't know what those problems are, you don't know how to work on them, which is part of my job as an instructor is tell you how to work on them, then it's not going to happen. So, you know, the balance starts with you understanding that you want to have the balance. Then you have to have the willingness. It's that AA stuff all over, Alcoholics Anonymous stuff all over again. You know, there's no one answer where you just snap your fingers and say, you're imbalanced. I'm going to snap my fingers. I'm going to tell you the magic three words. And now you're going to balance yourself and become a better player. Life doesn't work that way. So unfortunately, I can't just say, oh, well, they should do X and now they'll be fine. There is no X. There's a combination of X's and depends on their attitudes and everything else that combine do those things. But that is just, you know, I tell people on my website, if you're looking for easy answers, if you're looking for me saying some magic thing that'll make you a better player, like, oh, you're 1100, but you're playing Hope Chess. If you don't play Hope Chess, you'll be 1700 tomorrow. I don't think I've ever had a student. Now, Will Yu, who I talk about in my book, he was a brilliant guy who was kind of playing Hope Chess because he wasn't paying much attention. And then all of a sudden he decided he was playing in the team tournament. He had to play a lot better. He actually did kind of turn a switch and go from like 1200 to 1700, almost like magic. Hmm. And that helped me understand what Hope Chess was when Will did that. But there's not too many people like Will. The average person, I've never really met anyone else that where they're 1100 and you just tell them oomph and all of a sudden they can play much, much, much stronger. It just doesn't work that way. What you tell them is if you don't do oomph, you can't get stronger. But if you do oomph, it's going to take you a while practicing it. And even if you practice it, you're not going to be very good at it. And it's going to take you, you know, months and months and months and years of playing decent players and practicing slow games to get into these things where you can really do it better, find better moves, compare better moves. You know, that's how you're going to get better. But it takes work. And I lose students that way. Once they realize, oh, my goodness, do I have to actually do all this work to get better? In that case, why did I hire you? I'll save my money. Forget it. No more lessons. or they say, I'll do three lessons and then I'll do a DeGroote for them. And they'll think out loud for me. And then I'll say, oh, let's go through the DeGroote and compare you with what Alexander Alyakin did or what Dr. Uwe did. And we'll see all the things that you did wrong that maybe you could do better when you do better. And then some of my students open their eyes and go, oh, my goodness. My thought process is that bad. Oh, that was a great lesson from Dan. But now I realize, oh, taking chess lessons, it's going to take me a long time to get better because I have all these things. Oh, well, I did that DeGroote exercise. Maybe that'll be my last lesson.
Right.
So these things do happen in my job, but that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate those insights. That's helpful. So those are all my questions on the topic for today of popular and common mistakes that club players make. But I'd just like to finish this interview with just maybe one, for lack of a better phrase, a fun question. You know, at the time of this recording, we've had 5 rounds in the candidates. This episode will be released in 6 days from now. So the candidates will still be going on. I know it'll be maybe a little bit dated at that point, but nonetheless, I'll ask you anyhow. After 5 rounds, has there been anything that surprised you compared to what you expected would happen in this tournament?
Well, the favorites were Ding and Ferrugia, and right now they're all, neither of them has won a game yet, I think. Yeah. So, I mean, when I say they haven't won a game, obviously they've drawn most of their games, but they haven't won one. So they're trailing behind, but it's early yet. I mean, the 2012 candidates, which were really exciting, were like decided crazily in the last day.
Oh, wow.
And I like to make the comparison with Bobby Fischer playing the 1966 Piatigorsky Cup. The 1966 Piatigorsky Cup was sort of like a candidates tournament. It was a super grandmaster tournament. And Fischer was rusty. He hadn't played in a little bit, even though I think he had the highest rating in the world. They were just starting to do, like, they had USCF ratings. I'm not sure if they had FIDE ratings quite yet. But Fischer started out terribly. And playing 9 of the best players in the world, I think in the first 9, he only won, like, 3.5 out of 9. He was like 3.5, 5.5 or something. And everybody's like, what's wrong with Bobby Fischer? You know, he's like supposed to be the best player in the world. And then in the second half, even though world champion Petrosian was playing and candidate world champion player who played against Petrosian Spassky was playing, Fischer in the second half won 7.5 out of 9. He had 6 wins and 3 draws against the top players in the world.
Wow.
And he just barely couldn't catch Spassky. I guess that was the tournament where Spassky played the King's Gambit against them in the first half of it. But he ended up finishing 0.5 point behind first. But he was like in next to last after the he was like in 8th or 9th place after the first half. In the second half, he just said, "Oh, I'm way better than all you guys," and he just just completely killed everybody and made up almost all the ground. Well, I think of things like that, and I saw a comment that Nepo has traditionally done poorly at the end of long tournaments because he doesn't have good stamina. No, I didn't know that, and he's leading the tournament right now. So if he's been working out and he's in good shape and his stamina is better, then obviously he has a good chance. I'm sure Carlson's not going to be very – Carlson doesn't want to play Nepo again, I'm sure. He wanted to play the younger generation, and Ferrugia is the only one from the younger generation. If Ferrugia becomes Bobby Fischer and all of a sudden starts winning, you know, 7.5 out of his next 9 games. Like, let's see, they've done 5 and there's 9 to go, I guess, right? Because there's only 8 players. Right. So if Ferrugia goes 7.5, 1.5, he will win the candidates easily. Can he do that? Well, Bobby Fischer was way higher rated than everybody else in the world. So he could do that. This is almost a tournament among equals. I think the spread between the highest rated player and the lowest rated player is only about 50 points.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think in that case, anybody who's having a, like up to this tournament, Caruana's been rather, you know, having not great tournaments, and he's been playing very solidly so far. And and we know that Ding was the highest rated player coming in, and he got off to a little bit of a slow start. So any of these guys can really get something going like Nepo did a couple years ago and win the tournament. So I would be surprised if the lower three guys were one of those guys, you know, mm-hmm. who all of a sudden wins the tournament. But the other five, who aren't that much higher than the lower three, they all really have decent chances at this point. And the fact that the highest rated players are not near the top of the list makes it even more likely that it's going to be a close race. And we may see something like 2012 again, where everybody's going to be leaning on their seats the last day. Well, if this guy can draw and this guy can win, you know, he's going to be the challenger.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Great points. And I guess the main one is maybe it's still just way too early to say anything yet based on past experiences, like you said.
Right. Well, it's always good to, just like I was talking about, people like to study openings. Grandmasters want to get off to good starts in the tournament. I'm sure Nepo feels a lot better with, you know, let's see, what has he got? 3.5 out of 5? I think that's right. Did they play five or they played six?
I think he has 3.5 right now.
After 3.5 out of 5. Yeah. So I'm sure he feels a lot better. I think the lowest person probably has 4 draws and a loss, maybe. I don't think anyone's lost 2. So the lowest person probably has 2. So he's 1.5 ahead. Well, I'm sure at this point he feels a lot better than they do. But, you know, it's a long way to go. And the interesting point is, to some extent, with maybe 1 or 2 exceptions, almost anybody could lose any game.
Right.
Anybody can beat any, even with black. It's not like, oh, well, so-and-so with black can't possibly beat so-and-so with white. That's probably not true here. So we'll get some more unexpected results, and all of a sudden somebody else will pop their head up, or 2 people will. And, you know, if that doesn't happen, if like Nepo runs away with the tournament, I would be very surprised. It's not impossible. Anything's possible. But, you know, that would be surprising.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it reminds me of an expression I think that's often said about just sports in general, which is, the uncertainty is why you watch. Right. I mean, it's like because we don't know, that's why we're all still so engaged in it.
Right. Chess is a little bit more like baseball than some of the, like in baseball, a really terrible team wins 40% of their games, and a really good team, I mean, this year the Yankees are winning like 70% of their games, but you traditionally a really good team wins 60 to 65% of their games. Well, that doesn't work in the other sports, you know. And in basketball, if you only win 60% of your games, you're like a number 4 seed in the East or West. Mm-hmm. You know, in football, if you only win 60% of your games, you're praying that you make the playoffs. Mm-hmm. So chess is a lot more like baseball, where, you know, on any given day, somebody can easily win a game. And, you know, the players are very, very close in ability, so that it's very, very possible that on any day somebody can win. So, you know, unless you get a Magnus Carlsen or Bobby Fischer best among equals all of a sudden, or a Garry Kasparov in his prime, and then you say, well, gee, Gary's the favorite here. He doesn't win every single tournament, but he's always up there near the top. And this kind of tournament, there's nobody who's so much better than everybody else that, you know, we could say that at this point, you know, wait till he gets going. Well, it could be anybody. I mean, every single one of those 8 guys right now is saying to himself, it could be me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you, Dan, for sharing all your thoughts on this. It's been great talking with you today and getting more of your wisdom on this subject. There's so much to cover on this big broad category that this may be like part 1 of 2 or 3. But nonetheless, we did take a good chunk out of it today and addressed a lot. So I thank you again for being on the show and for all your wisdom. It's much appreciated. And so, yeah, just thank you very much.
Well, thanks for letting me chat. I know I'm the guest and I get to chat, but sometimes I sit here and go, oh man, I hate the fact that answer was so long. It makes me sound like I'm like going on and on and on.
No. I mean, that's actually, it's all by design on my part. I try to ask questions that can give good lengthy answers. So it's all intentional and perfect for the show. So again, well, thank you. Yeah.
I'm glad I'm not meeting someone for the first time and trying to make a good impression. They would walk away saying, boy, that guy doesn't know when to stop.
No worries about that at all here. So yeah, thanks, Dan. And I'd love to have you back again sometime in the future. So again, appreciate you being on and look forward to chatting again.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me on again.
Thanks for listening. This has been a production of My Business Adult Chess Academy.
And that has a website with the same name if you want to look for it. You can also find me being way too active on Twitter by searching my username, Lona_chess. See you next week.